Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lara Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our October series, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. With elections coming up in New York and New Jersey, we're asking what unbalanced power relationships contribute to making housing so unaffordable in greater New York. Decade after decade, even as every New York mayor announces historic affordable housing programs and every New Jersey governor comes with a plan to get property taxes under control. We're doing segments on these things throughout the month of October here on The Brian Lara Show, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. Jessica Gould from the WNYC News team covers development and gentrification and has been investigating some of the power relationships that help keep housing unaffordable, and she is back with us now for the third straight day with what I'll call the dirty little secret of New York City housing politics. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, that's enticing.
And you have brought with you Cesare Podkol, Wall Street Journal reporter, formerly with ProPublica, and Will Parker, who reports for the real estate-oriented site Real Deal. Why these guys?
Okay, so last year I was working with these guys when they started a very major investigation into how much developers give to candidates on the state level. So New York City developers giving to candidates upstate and in Long Island, as well as in New York City, and what those legislators have done seemingly in return. And I just wanted to say about the dirty little secret, we've been talking a lot about how developers influence housing in New York City, but the city's power over some major affordable housing issues is actually limited to land use and zoning. That's why we've been talking about that a lot. Rent laws are decided on the state level, so rent stabilization and how tight those laws are or relatively weak, that's just decided by the state. And the city's tax system, so the property tax system, which favors homeowners over renters, and the lucrative 421A tax break, I believe it's called Affordable New York now, which is a tax break for developers who build affordable housing, all of that negotiated by the state.
And Cesare, I see an example that you gave in one of your articles was right in the lead of a ProPublica article that you wrote. You wrote, in 2014, an obscure campaign in the foothills west of Albany between a sheep farmer and a home builder mushroomed into one of the most expensive state senate elections in New York history. So what does this thing in the foothills outside of Albany have to do with affordable housing in New York City?
It has to do with what Jessica just mentioned, that because rent laws are controlled by the state, it's up to state lawmakers to weaken or strengthen them. And the way the real estate industry is able to exact control over those laws is by making sure that the state Senate remains in Republican hands. The Republicans have historically been friendly to landlords and property owners' causes. So in the analysis that we did looking at how much money big property developers give, we found that they've very heavily favored Republicans, and especially in Long Island and upstate races like this George Amador versus CeCe Katchick race, to make sure that those seats don't go to Democrats, because every seat that goes to Democrats means that they stand to lose control of the Senate, and if they do, then potentially rent laws could get stronger.
So New York City's rent laws are passed by the state legislature. So are what kinds of tax breaks developers can get for creating affordable housing, as Jessica was just saying. That's crazy when you think about it, Will. Why is it like that?
So in the example of the rent laws, this goes back to the early 1970s. There is a bill called the Erstat Law, which was named after Governor Rockefeller's housing commissioner, Charles Erstat, which essentially stipulated that the city of New York could not pass more stringent rent laws than the state could, and gave control of those laws to the state legislature. There have, of course, been many attempts by mostly Senate Democrats to repeal that law over the years, but they've been unsuccessful up to this point. And for, you know, upstate senators, Republicans especially, they don't have the constituency that many senators do in New York City of those rent-stabilized tenants. So, you know, many see it as easier for those politicians to make votes that may anger tenants in New York City, but don't affect their constituents upstate.
And Jessica, it's one thing if the city does something that has implications in other parts of the state, that the state controls it. But when the city does things, and of course this applies to other localities in the state too, with respect to the limited home rule that they have, when the city wants to do things that just affect people in New York City, like Mayor de Blasio right now wants to raise the city income tax just on the top 1% of earners, $500,000 for a single, $1 million a year earnings for a couple. He wants to raise the city income tax just on those folks to fund some transit things. And it's not up to the city. It's up to the state, even though it wouldn't raise taxes on anyone anywhere else.
Right. So it's a power imbalance that I think the mayor has fought hard against in his way. But it's the way the state constitution was written.
And, you know, that's one argument that people are making right now for voting yes on the Election Day ballot question about a New York State Constitutional Convention. Take powers like that away from Albany and restore home rule to New York City and other locales. There are many reasons that some progressives oppose a constitutional convention. We had a big debate on that on the show the other day, and we'll do more coverage. But the potential for more home rule is one reason that some are for it, just saying that for context, because it's relevant to this election. Cesare, I see you had a piece in the Journal last week called Rent Gadfly Takes on New York Landlords One Building at a Time. Aaron Carr organizes class action lawsuits. So who is this Aaron Carr, and how does he connect with what we're talking about in this series, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition?
Sure. He's a young guy, 29 years old, who's doing regulators' work for them when it comes to enforcing state rent laws. You know, one of the things that all these campaign contributions arguably give or result in is weak enforcement of all these state rent laws. So Aaron Carr, who used to work as a chief of staff to Assemblyman Michael Blake, realized that very little was being done to enforce these laws, and he created this nonprofit housing rights initiative last year through which he's organizing lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit against big property owners who break rent laws. One of the people he targeted was A&E, which is one of the contributors raised money for Mayor de Blasio. So he's targeting, big fish, and he's going after big targets. And it's something to watch because he's got a lot more of these lawsuits planned. And it's just strange that this is how rent laws are getting enforced, rather than through very proactive enforcement.
Jessica, I see you have some clips of people supporting or shrugging off this idea of campaign donations going so much to people outside the city in order to make city policy through the state legislature. Who is John Banks?
So John Banks is the head of the Real Estate Board of New York, and I spoke to him.
That represents developers and landlords?
Right. It is a huge contributor to state politics, and its members contribute a lot to city politics, from the mayor on down to council members who have projects in their communities and in front of their committees. And I spoke to him about this investigation, as well as about the reason that the real estate industry gives so much money.
Every legislator's vote is valid, and we seek to work with anyone, Republican or Democrat, who supports the ideas and who's open to the position of the real estate industry. So their geographic location is meaningless to us as long as they provide a stable base for a conversation that is productive and reasonable and rational.
Wow, that's pure Machiavelli, right? He's not saying whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. They have power, so their vote is valid, so we're going to give money to them to get our interests furthered.
Yeah, money talks. I mean, I think that the renters who live under these rent stabilization laws and have experienced some of the difficulties that stem from them don't think that it's meaningless where the legislators live.
And it's not just the developers who take advantage of this system. It's also the unions. So you have another clip of someone else.
That's right. I spoke with Gary LaBarbera, who's president of the Building Trades Council, which represents the workers who work on a lot of these projects. Looking at the mayor's campaign for One New York, unions gave over a million dollars. I think it was 1.3, and the real estate industry gave $1 million. So there's, when we talk about real estate influence, it's both the unions and the developers. And so I spoke with him about whether the money that they give actually has an influence on policy.
You know, there's a system. And again, we can agree or disagree with the system, but there is a system. While I think that contributions, you know, play a role, obviously, in terms of supporting a candidate, in terms of creating some access to the candidate. I think that's a fair assessment. I don't necessarily believe that money actually controls policy.
That's an amazing statement, Will. They give all this money from all corners of the real estate sector, the developers, as we just heard, the unions, as we just heard, and then they say it's about nothing.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Money is about policy. The politicians create policy and the donors give the money for that purpose. There's not really another explanation. And when John Banks spoke about, you know, the people they give money to doesn't have to do a geographical location, that's true only in the sense that they're giving to Senate Republicans who tend to be located outside of New York City, who tend to be responsive to their lobbying. So geography is only irrelevant insofar as it's Senate Republicans first, geography second.
And what about city politics and real estate power? We've been talking throughout this series about a key stat from last year that I got from Wall Street Journal article that mentioned 16 of the top 26 campaign donation bundlers for Mayor de Blasio's reelection campaign that's, of course, underway right now. 16 of the 26 top campaign donation bundlers were lobbyists or others from the real estate industry. What do they want for that money from city policy, and what do they get?
So with the city, it's a separate set of issues. One of the major things they're looking for are friendly rules for rezoning. So when developers want to take land that's been set for commercial purposes, for example, and build a large residential condominium or another, you know, rental property. It's also things like construction rules, which have been very important lately. There was a bill that passed the city council that would require hours more safety classes for construction workers in the city aimed at preventing a spike in deaths at sites. This was, of course, a big battleground for the unions and the real estate industry. The real estate industry opposed the legislation because it would chip away at the cost they save by going with non-union labor. And of course, the unions supported the bill because they already provide that level of safety training. So you see the same union versus real estate fight in the city and at the state level.
All right. Well, that's today's edition of People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition, which we're doing all through October here on The Brian Lehrer Show. I thank our reporter for development and gentrification, Jessica Gould, who's been with us on the show 3 days in a row now with some of the things that she's learned digging into this. Great work, Jessica. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we thank today's additional guests, Cesare Podkol, Wall Street Journal reporter, formerly with ProPublica, and Will Parker, who reports for the real estate-oriented site Real Deal. Thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Much more to come.